So, Susan, as we learned this week, I want to know if this is really true. Did you really not know there are 9 innings in a baseball game?
So the people of Twitter are, like, shocked at this. It's not that I didn't know. It was I wasn't positive there were 9 innings in a baseball game.
You were sort of sure?
There's knowledge that you really need to acquire, and then there's knowledge that you just don't need.
So you got all this time not knowing that
like
they're
9,
a basic
7. I feel like 7 was a thing.
Fact that most Americans take for granted.
You've heard of 7th inning stretch. You haven't heard of 9th inning stretch.
But colloquially, hadn't you run into the phrase the bottom of the 9th?
Yeah, but how does that mean the end? I guess now we know the answer is
yes. Your skepticism is beginning to make more sense. Are there other things?
As knowledge gap goes, I've managed to live a full and productive life without knowing this about baseball.
Are there things that other people have not known their whole life?
Well, I will admit to being 17 and going for the first time with a friend to visit the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and being really impressed by how many people were there and going back home and asking, so who's buried in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre?
In your defense, he's not really buried there.
How about you, Shane?
Oh, I was born with perfect knowledge.
Ah, okay.
A walking Wikipedia.
Of a very limited number of things. What about you, Ben?
For me, it's whole categories of things that everybody else takes for granted, like things involving pop culture,
anything in the style section, basically.
Yeah, I mean, things you know that everybody else just knows as a result of being a teenager or ever having thought about being a teenager. I learned only relatively recently when my kids started saying the name the person whose name is spelled Beyonce, that name was not pronounced Bay once.
She is the Queen Bay, so it's not entirely ridiculous, but
I'm sorry. It is more ridiculous to not know how to pronounce Beyonce than to not know how many innings are in a baseball game.
Hello and welcome to Rational Security, the I Thought You Said Renuclearization Edition. I'm Shane Harris, fully informed pop culture reporter. I don't report on pop culture, but I'm fully informed on pop culture. Well, for the most part.
Can I just say that Donald Trump seems just like Susan is the only person who doesn't know that there are 9 innings in a baseball game, and I am the only person who doesn't know how to pronounce Beyonce. Donald Trump seems to be the only person who's surprised that North Korea isn't, you know, racing to denuclearize.
Here's the difference.
What?
Susan now knows there are 9 innings in a baseball game.
Yeah, whereas Trump is still having trouble with the idea that Russia may have been somehow involved in our election.
That's fake news.
Yeah, you would have thought that he would have, like, using the baseball metaphor after Singapore, would have said, you know, we're in the beginning of the first inning here. Like, we've just thrown out the first pitch. And it was the series is over and we can go home. But yeah, not working out that way so much as we're going to discuss. I'm here in the Jungle Studio with my friend Susan Hennessy, Benjamin Wittes, and Tamara Kaufman Wittes. Hi, everybody.
Hi. Yo.
Happy 5th of July. I hope everyone had a good holiday.
It's a sultry holiday.
It's miserable in the nation's capital, weather-wise. This week on the podcast, U.S. intelligence says North Korea is not giving up its nukes, at least not so quickly. Should the next Supreme Court justice recuse on matters involving Trump and the Russia probe, and the war in Afghanistan grinds on with little notice as Trump heads off to a tense meeting with NATO allies. So let's start with, I guess, I don't know if it's just too flip of me to say surprise, surprise about U.S. intelligence reports on North Korea, but reports this week in the past few days too, really, that the Defense Intelligence Agency has concluded that North Korea is not, at least not moving right now, to give up its nuclear weapons. Satellite imagery shows construction going on at key facilities as part of the nuclear program. Susan, let me ask you, I mean, is this process coming off the rails even before it's begun, or is it not terribly surprising that, you know, these pieces of the program would still be humming along since we don't actually even have a deal per se.
Yeah, so I think as a threshold matter, that's sort of the core point, right? We never understood what the deal was in the first place, right? They never actually bothered to write it down, and it wasn't clear whether there was even a common definition of what denuclearization meant. I think sort of the most interesting thing from my perspective right now is the intelligence community has now made public a finding that conflicts with the president's narrative, right? That he went and he had this summit. It was a win. He was successful. He accomplished something that no other presidents were able to accomplish. And now this is sort of the evidentiary basis to say, no, that's not actually what happened. And so we still haven't heard Trump weigh in on this and explain whether or not he accepts this finding, or as he's done with the Russian election interference, if he's just going to dismiss it altogether. I worry that something even more profound might be occurring, which is not that he's going to concern himself with whether or not what the North Koreans are actually doing, but he's now convinced himself that the North Koreans are not a threat at all. That he went and he developed this rapport and had this relationship, and therefore we're good, and there's nothing else to worry about here. And so, you know, whether or not they continue to build nuclear weapons, you know, whatever they're doing, it doesn't concern us because, you know, he walked us back from the precipice of war. And I think that's sort of the more profound concern, at least in terms of how Trump's brain kind of works about these issues.
Yeah, so I think there are two ways to interpret what we've seen so far. One is thinking about it through the lens of Trump always trying to drive the public narrative. And he had his photo op with Kim Jong-un. He created a narrative that he had solved this problem. He kicked it off to Mike Pompeo and U.S. diplomats to figure out all the details. And so it's off his plate, out of his mind. He got the headlines he wanted. If that's the case, then, you know, Pompeo, who's heading off to the Korean Peninsula today to keep working on this and to meet with the North Koreans, will eventually come back to the president and say, hey, in order to really get this done, I need your backup on X, Y, and Z. And he might get it. But if you're right, Susan, if there's a psychological component to this, which is that Trump truly believes that he has solved this problem, then when Pompeo comes back to him, as any senior diplomat would eventually have to do in a high-stakes negotiation, comes back to his president and says, I need you to back me up on X, Y, and Z, Trump will say, what the hell are you talking about? I can't, you know, this is completely irrelevant. Why are you bringing me this? Go away. And the negotiation will collapse. So I agree with you that that is the scarier scenario. But it's, you know, I guess the one thing we can say about this is that there is a process underway of U.S.-North Korean negotiations that was started by the summit. It's kicked off without clear definitions of terms, without an agreed-upon objective. All of that is clearly revealed. The intelligence demonstrates that the North Koreans were expanding their nuclear weapons program at the very moment that Kim Jong-un was meeting with President Trump. So there's a question about whether they're even acting in good faith on all of this. But at least there's a process that one way or another will generate a conclusion, you know, either success or failure.
I mean, one question I do have sort of to everybody is, why do we think this leaked, right? This is actually quite a detailed bit of information to come out about. You know, North Korea is a very hard target. This is an area in which the intelligence community tends to be pretty skittish about revealing information at the risk of compromising sources and methods. I do think there's something interesting to be said. I'm not quite sure what about the fact that somebody in the intelligence community or in the diplomatic corps is concerned enough that they felt like they needed to make this public.
I think it could also have been somebody in the White House. Remember that the president is surrounded by people who are actually hardliners on this subject, including John Bolton, who is in no sense somebody who is spoiling for a conciliatory relationship with Kim Jong-un. And so my assumption is that to the extent that there are disclosures here, they would be likely coming out of factions of the White House crew that are maybe not that interested in facilitating the president's policy.
Yeah, look, I think the leak is that U.S. intelligence officials had drawn some conclusions about the North Koreans' intentions based on what they've seen. But the initial revelation that satellite imagery showed the North Koreans expanding their facilities, that actually came out of a think tank, the Stimson Center, which has a project, a longtime project on nuclear nonproliferation. And that's actually more common than not in proliferation issues these days, because satellite imagery is so widely available, even of hard targets like North Korea. So there's definitely some leaking going on here, and we can speculate about the motives. But the driver of the news coverage that created, you know, that demonstrated that what the North Koreans are doing counters President Trump's narrative, that driver came from open sources, not from classified ones.
And I think to Ben's point, I mean, there are clearly people, John Bolton is one of them, who are interested in the public narrative being that this is going to be a lot harder than just saying, hey, we have peace with North Korea and we're all said and done, and who don't believe for one second, I think, that North Korea can be a reliable partner in this until we've seen demonstrable evidence that they want to move forward on a negotiation. It seems to me what this is also showing, pointing up, is that, and I think to the point of the leaking, there are a lot of people in the intelligence community, I think, who want these things coming out, because part of this process is not just striking a deal with North Korea, it is managing the president, or to some degree trying to downplay or deflect away from his hyperbolic triumphalist statements on Twitter, which are just simply not grounded in reality. And intelligence officials know that. Members of Congress know that. I think on some level, even the president knows that. I mean, he understands that there is, to your point, Tammy, I think there is the kind of the marketing side of this, right? The sort of the narrative that he wants to build. It wouldn't surprise me at all to find out, though, that the president is, you know, constantly wanting updates and is aware of the fact that these, you know, satellite imagery show construction. I mean, he's not completely detached. But the leaking out of this information, I think, really helps maintain to some degree the credibility of the intelligence agencies as well. They don't want people, I think, believing that they are, you know, buying into some, you know, fanciful idea that suddenly, you know, we have peace with North Korea.
I agree with that. I just don't think we should assume that there is something adversarial going on here with respect to the president or the White House. I mean, to a certain extent, having it out there publicly that the intelligence analysis has come to these conclusions strengthens Mike Pompeo's hand when he gets to North Korea tonight or tomorrow for these conversations.
Totally. But Pompeo also, to that point, was the first person to come out from the administration, I think within a day or two of the Singapore summit, and say, well, we're looking forward to the North Koreans being on their way to making progress by the end of the first term. I mean, immediately starts pulling back, because mm-hmm. he knows damn well, he knows better than anyone, he has been the lead on all these negotiations, that this is a process that's going to be measured in months and years, not in weeks.
So I want to say a tentative word in defense of the Trump administration on North Korea. So let's control for the crazy rhetoric and leave aside whether any of that has been helpful or hurtful or something else in getting us to this place. But 18 months ago, Barack Obama meets with Donald Trump and says to him, this is the hardest problem on our plate. This is the most serious national security issue. This is where the real action is North Korean missile development and nuclear weapons development. And at the time, the new North Koreans were testing missiles on a very regular basis. And today they are not testing nuclear, they are not testing ballistic missiles. They are not doing tests of nuclear weapons either. And if the scope of current North Korean activity is that they are expanding some construction at a particular facility, that is actually a substantial improvement over where we were 18 months ago. Yeah. And I am willing to entertain all kinds of explanations for this, like that they reached the point that they needed to be at, and so they then decided to engage in a political process. It could be that maybe they actually got scared by some of Trump's belligerent rhetoric. I'm agnostic as to what the explanation is. Yet I think if you could have said 18 months ago to Barack Obama, 18 months from now, take it or leave it, we have essentially a freeze in place. You haven't removed sanctions, and they've suspended testing both of the weapons and of the missiles. Take it or leave it. Barack Obama takes that in a heartbeat. Yeah. And so I actually think the Trump administration, in its own crazy way, has a not terrible story to tell on North Korea. The problem is it's not the story they're telling. The story they're telling is we've solved the North Korean problem. They're not a nuclear threat anymore.
Well, that's the story the president's telling, but privately people in his own administration are not telling that story.
On the other hand, you know, the president's, you know, the president is the administration.
True.
And when he chooses not to tell that story, but to tell a different story that's fantastical instead, you know, the administration has to live with that. I actually think, in contrast to a lot of other areas, this is one where the truth is at least complicatedly attractive from their point of view.
But what you're saying is also, I mean, that's the entire administration writ large, right? The president tweets one set of things, and then there's the other plane of reality on which, you know, we're all living.
Yeah, I think the other real issue, Ben, is whether the naivete, the ignorance, the lack of preparation, whatever, with which Trump himself and his administration approached the diplomacy with the North Koreans, whether it gave away leverage that the United States had available to it and therefore got less, in fact, so far has essentially gotten nothing except a halt in tests because the North Koreans escalated tests in order to get the attention of the United States government, and lo, they got the attention of the United States government, so they halted tests, but they could start them again in a heartbeat. They have not agreed to halt tests. They haven't agreed to anything.
I agree. We are not at an end state. I do think if you'd said 18 months ago to Barack Obama, hey, take this reality or leave it, he would have taken it. And I think at every stage between then and now, if you'd said we could be at this place now, people would have said, great, sign me up. And I don't think that's anything to sneeze at.
Yeah, I mean, just a final word. I feel like that's forgetting a part of the narrative, which is that the North Koreans provoked, yes, but it's inevitable that they were going to provoke. They provoke every new president. The difference here is how President Trump responded. He escalated. He created a crisis, and then he used a summit to de-escalate a crisis. So you're congratulating him for de-escalating a crisis that never had to be. Previous presidents have not ended up in a major escalation of tensions with the North Koreans at the beginning of their presidency. They've responded to those same provocations differently. They've worked multilaterally. They've, yes, started diplomatic processes. But so now we have a diplomatic process. It hasn't achieved anything yet. And if you're saying it de-escalated, well, it de-escalated something he escalated.
I just one final thought on that. I don't think that's accurate. The escalation, we are at a lower state of escalation than we were before Trump took office. The missile testing that was taking place for months and months and months before Trump took office is not, you know, that is suspended as well. You know, I don't think he has simply escalated tensions and then de-escalated what he escalated.
Where are we on the escalator?
I don't know, but I know that
we're riding the banister.
Yeah, folks love it when Ben and I disagree on the show. So,
well, if you thought North Korea was tough,
I don't know. That was kind of a stretch.
I don't know. I was going to use something that was said like a minute ago in a transition, but it was that we've lost the thread. President Trump on Monday is expected to announce his nominee for the vacancy on the Supreme Court. This interesting debate, I don't even know if I want to call it a debate. We'll decide what we think it actually is. But the idea has arisen, shall we say, that
some people say.
Many people are saying.
People are saying.
Everyone is saying.
Not quite. Some people are saying. And we'll talk about who. That the president's nominee for the court should agree to recuse himself or herself from any matters that might come before the court involving the president and the Russia investigation. So, for instance, if Bob Mueller were to subpoena Trump to demand an interview in the Russia probe and the president said no, and this issue gets adjudicated and goes to the Supreme Court, should Trump's nominee say, I will recuse myself from this matter because I was the president's nominee? It's not clear to me why Neil Gorsuch wouldn't also need to recuse from that too. But Ben, is this a good idea? I mean, is this it's a credible thing that we should be holding the justice nominee to this standard, or is this just a silly proposition?
Well, I don't know whether to attach the word silly to it. It's not the way the judiciary works. And, you know, we don't say to nominees, because you were nominated by President X, you don't get to rule on matters that President X has an interest in. And, you know, the Nixon tapes case, to cite one example, the opinion was written by Chief Justice Warren Burger, who was appointed to the Supreme Court by Richard Nixon, and the other two Nixon nominees to the Supreme Court were also members of the court at the time. And so the rule of recusal is that you recuse when you have a conflict demanding recusal in the case. And that is not a kind of general optical thing that, hey, you're politically aligned with so-and-so, or you were appointed by so-and-so, and I really don't, like, so-and-so is involved in this case, and therefore you don't sit on it. It generally requires a more specific conflict with respect to the specific case.
So, like, he nominates Mike Flynn for the Supreme Court. That's,
well, so
or what if, rather than the individual nominated, what if the president, having learned from his experience with Jeff Sessions, explicitly asks potential nominees, if a case came before you involving, you know, my right to refuse to testify to the special counsel, would you help me out?
Well, so anybody who would answer that question, by virtue of answering that question, should certainly not be confirmed because they are ethically unfit to be on the Supreme Court.
So I largely agree with Ben, but I think it's less sort of an absurd proposition than I think you might, Ben. So I think the first thing to understand is, so the code of conduct, the judicial code of conduct, is binding on all lower courts, but it's not binding on the Supreme Court. So the ordinary recusal rules, which are about whether or not there's even the appearance of impartiality, or whether or not you have sort of personal bias or prejudice, right? So you're related to somebody in a case, something like that. Elena Kagan recused herself from any cases in which she worked on while in the Solicitor General's office, right? So really sort of close contacts. For Supreme Court justices, the judicial code is not binding on them because there's no other judge to replace them. So ordinarily, whenever we're thinking about recusal in the lower courts, we're talking about which judge hears the case. But recusal of the Supreme Court is a different thing. And so we shouldn't be thinking about it with the same standard that we do ordinary judges. That said, I think that the world we're in is that there aren't rules. It certainly would be absurd for a Supreme Court justice to recuse themselves from any matter involving the administration to which they've been appointed. I mean, that just wouldn't be feasible. But in this case, I do think the question is, if there's any belief that the president has selected a justice because he believes that person will be favorable to him on an issue involving his personal or his family member's criminal liability potentially, or something like whether or not he can pardon himself, you know, questions that he has put on the table by raising himself. If there's any sort of belief that he's, whenever he's looking at these people, he's picking one of them because of that, then I do think you have a question about whether or not recusal is appropriate. And I think that it's not one where you say that person is bound to recuse. They're never bound to recuse, but it is a reasonable thing to put on the table in the confirmation process that if you have a candidate who is otherwise acceptable, but there's this lingering doubt, this little thing of, well, are you being picked because you're gonna do the president, not even because you're gonna do the president a favor, but because he believes your judicial interpretation sort of renounced to his benefit, you know, removing that question from the nomination process by saying, look, I understand this perception, and I'm gonna voluntarily in advance say that I wouldn't work on that case because, you know, of course I would never want to damage the reputation of the court. I don't think it's gonna happen. I don't think anyone on that list is gonna do it, but I don't think it's an insane suggestion.
A couple thoughts. First of all, I think there's an antecedent question that probably resolves the issue better, which is let's imagine for a minute that the nominee is Amy Coney Barrett, just that we have a name to attach to it. So presumably she gets asked in the hearing, in your interviews with the president and the White House, did anybody ask you about the Russia investigation, right? Did anybody ask you how you feel about the Bob Mueller investigation? Did anybody suggest to you that you should, you know, show loyalty to the president in the context? Presumably these questions are going to come up. Presumably everybody in the White House was smart enough not to say something to her that she will have to say, why, yes, the president said, you know, I need loyalty, or, you know, something like that. If she were to say that, that would, of course, be grounds for recusal, and maybe grounds for, you know, not confirming her. But assuming she then says under oath in front of the Senate, there were no such conversations, then I look at her and say, well, then she's just an appellate court nominee who the president may have hopes as to how she would rule in the thing, but there's no evidence of anything untoward. And then you're just saying, well, she's a conservative who was appointed by him.
But what if the name is not Amy Coney Barrett, but instead Brett Kavanaugh, somebody who within the past decade wrote a very detailed law review article in which he took positions on the independent counsel statutes and took positions that a reasonable observer and even the president himself would likely reach the conclusion that that he does not believe the president should be distracted by these forms of investigations, and he has put his legal conclusions and legal conclusions that renown to the president's benefit out there. If Trump looks at that law review article and says, oh, look, you don't think that Mueller can subpoena me, and so therefore I'm going to appoint you, even if nobody verbalizes that, even if there isn't a direct question, if there is a sufficient appearance that that's what's animating Trump's choice, and look, don't sell the president short, he might just say it outright because, you know, you never know. You don't think that that's any different?
It's an interesting example. I am aware of one law review article that Kavanaugh wrote that actually cuts the other direction, and I'm not aware of a article that he wrote that.
Well, but take the hypothetical, because I think the hypothetical is good, whether or not it's accurate with respect to Brett Kavanaugh in particular.
So it may well be. I mean, the guy's prolific, and he certainly has executive power beliefs. Look, what I would say is judges come forward with their prior academic writings all the time, and the president appoints people all the time, and the Senate goes through this dance of saying, yeah, but how does this interact with what you would do as a judge? And the nominees say, I would, you know, follow the facts and the law
right,
in the case before me, and my, you know, I have other things I would be faithful to other than my own academic writings. And then they tend to write in ways that are generally philosophically consistent with their academic writings. And so my view is, if a senator wants to read law Law Review article by Brett Kavanaugh and says that's where his heart is, and therefore I'm not going to confirm him. That strikes me as an altogether fair evaluation, whether they were right or not, whether an altogether fair way for a senator to behave with respect to a nominee's prior record. But I'm not sure why that conveys any obligation on the part of the nominee to recuse from any given case.
But I don't think we're in the realm of obligations. We're in the realm of whether or not, look, as you've written previously, right, there are no rules in Supreme Court confirmations. And so to the extent that this is sort of a Hail Mary by very concerned Democrats, would it be improper for someone to recuse? Well, right? It's voluntary.
So right now we're in a nomination process. There will be a confirmation. The confirmation itself, in a sense, is a referendum on the person and everything that they've said or done publicly prior to getting the nomination. So that would include a Law Review article that seems to suggest that they would be favorable to the president. So the remedy for that is senators voting no. Assuming somebody goes successfully through the confirmation process, you know, it seems to me then the bar gets a step higher in the sense that, as you noted, Susan, there needs to be an appearance of a conflict, an appearance of a problem. And the appearance would then be either the president himself saying something that suggests that this is why he made this pick, or that he has this expectation, or someone, you know, who was involved in the White House's staff decision saying this is how the decision happened. Then I think a justice should recuse. Then they have something in front of them that impugns their independence and their integrity. They would be wise to recuse.
I guess I would put just a slightly different sort of gloss on it, which is that there's nothing about these views themselves that are wrong or in bad faith or would be disqualifying someone from being confirmed, right? It actually doesn't go to the judge's fitness at all or their suitability to be a Supreme Court justice. It goes entirely to the president and him wielding his constitutional powers in ways that are improper. And so the question here would not be whether or not there isn't an individual on this list that I think you could actually say, you know, in good faith, this person's sort of in Trump's pocket. It's about whether or not Trump is improperly, as he has in the past, wielding his authorities in order to benefit himself on this very specific question. And so I just think we're in a world in which I would argue that maybe we should reverse the presumptions.
So I'll ask one very quick question. You made the point, Ben, that if the nominee is asked, did anybody in the White House ask you about your views on the Russia probe or on the subpoenas or these kinds of things? What if the answer is, I'm not going to discuss things that I discussed with the president? Is that a problem?
So first of all,
then presumably the answer is yes.
So first of all, that would be a departure from past practice on the part of the nominee, because it's a fully typical thing in the context of nominations to ask, did anybody ask you your views of Roe v. Wade? No. The question never came up. I was never asked about how I would rule on blah, blah, blah. So there is not a kind of executive privilege with respect. I'm using executive privilege there, loosely, you know, loosely. Yeah. But there's no principle that has operated in prior nominations that, you know, that there's some privilege against speaking about your conversations with the White House or the president. And in fact, nominees have been rather flamboyant about saying, nobody asked me about this. I was never talked to about why. And so a nominee who refused to answer that question, I think, could fairly be suspected of protecting something. And I would think that would set up a significant recusal motion. You know, if you were Justice Shane Harris and you testified,
that sounds great. I would vote to confirm you for sure.
And you'd testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee and been asked, were you asked about a pending investigation affecting the president? And you said, I'm not going to answer that question, Mr. Senator. I would think the special counsel might file a recusal motion that says, we have record evidence that you as a justice refuse to answer questions about your conversations mm-hmm. with the White House on this case, please recuse. I would think that would be a very substantial recusal motion.
Mm-hmm. I would only have one question for you, Shane, mm-hmm. if you were nominated for a federal judgeship. Mm-hmm. Do you know how many innings there are in a baseball game?
Supreme Court or bust for
and
you, baby.
How do you pronounce B-E-Y-O-N-C?
I don't discuss my views on baseball or pop culture, Senator.
I think this podcast has effectively disqualified anyone.
I think so. I think so. We are all recused and disqualified from so many walks of life. That's why we're here recording a podcast. There was a striking photograph last week that Tammy spotted actually on social media and flagged to me, and I think it made the rounds quite a bit.
So depressing.
Yeah, of a press briefing at the Pentagon on Afghanistan, which is, I think for some time, right, has been the longest war that American forces have served in. And there were about two reporters in the room in this vast room that can hold about 50 people. It was mostly empty chairs and two reporters.
Three reporters.
Okay. In fairness, we think there was an official who was also giving a televised or remote briefing from the field that was carried on a closed circuit. So there may have been other reporters watching from their desks back in their newsroom, but it was this striking visual of that made, I think, a lot of people sort of say, hey, whatever happened to that war in Afghanistan that we've been fighting? Tammy, it really has kind of remarkably fallen off the foreign policy and national security radar. And Trump is getting ready to go to the NATO summit at a time when he's questioned the value of our alliances, our military alliances, the commitment of our military commitment of our allies, their security commitments. Talk about what you're expecting vis-a-vis, you know, Afghanistan, I guess, as we go into this summit, and why is it that we seem to be, it seems to become an afterthought in policymaking?
Yeah, so it's really striking the extent to which the Trump administration and President Trump himself simply don't talk about Afghanistan. It's as though they want to forget about it. And so whereas, you know, in the early part of the Barack Obama administration, Afghanistan was called the good war and Iraq was called the bad war. You know, Afghanistan was the virtuous war, the war against the people who did 9/11, and their allies. And now Afghanistan is called the forever war because it is the longest military conflict in U.S. history and the forgotten war. And it's notable that President Trump hasn't visited U.S. troops in the field anywhere since he came into office.
Combat troops.
He hasn't been to Iraq or Afghanistan.
He's much more concerned with our troops along the U.S. border in the form of
CPB and ICE.
Exactly.
Right? You know, and so you can be forgiven for, you know, thinking that maybe the Trump administration simply doesn't care about this conflict and those who are fighting it and sort of wishes it would go away. The problem here is that, as you noted, this is a NATO conflict. The United States isn't in this alone. NATO forces have been with us from the very beginning because the only time NATO's Article 5 of collective self-defense has ever been invoked was in the wake of 9/11. So right now there are about 16,000 foreign troops as part of the NATO mission in Afghanistan, the Resolute Support mission. Fewer than two-thirds of those are U.S. troops. The bulk of the rest are EU, come from EU countries who are either NATO members or NATO partners, and about 10% come from other NATO members and NATO partners. There are 39 countries who contribute troops to the NATO mission. And so it's relevant that President Trump has spent the last couple months just trashing these allies. And usually in the summers, especially in June and July, the U.S. president goes to the series of summits, the G7 summit, the U.S.-EU summit, and the NATO summit. And they're usually quite in close proximity. And they are usually an occasion where the American president reinforces this Western democratic open market alliance of countries that help the United States achieve its goals and secure its interests all around the world. And this year, we already saw him blow up the G7 summit. I don't know that there is going to be a US-EU summit. I haven't heard anything about it. Could be wrong. And there are huge questions about whether he's even going to sit quietly through the core sessions of the NATO summit. And of course, immediately after the NATO summit, he's going off to meet one-on-one with Vladimir Putin. So what will be the attitude of other NATO members toward our mission in Afghanistan? Are they, facing their own domestic politics, going to continue to be willing to contribute troops to a mission that is, you know, driven by an American definition of NATO's interests and of international security? It is a UN-mandated operation, but it's been going on for a really long time, and other countries have shed blood alongside U.S. troops in the field in Afghanistan. So I could see especially some of our European allies looking at the Afghanistan mission as a place where they can cut some of their engagement with the United States without paying any domestic political price at home. And, you know, that could be a downward spiral pretty quickly.
So my question is, you know, whenever right after the election, there was sort of this list within the national security community of, well, here's the areas in which things are already so bad or already so complex and entrenched that maybe this is an area in which Trump really shaking things up, throwing out the old policy, forget the blob, bringing in something new. And Afghanistan was at the top of that list. We actually haven't heard the president talk about Afghanistan much at all, other than this alienation of NATO allies, which seems like it's nothing but downside to us. Is there any evidence that Trump or Mattis or this administration is thinking about Afghanistan differently than prior administrations have?
There has not been any radical policy departure. There hasn't been any major policy announcement. And when we look at what U.S. forces are doing, what the Resolute Support Mission is doing, it's very much as it was before, which is a security assistance mission to the Afghan military and Afghan police, trying to help them retake areas from the Taliban, police those areas, provide basic security, build trust with the population, and where they can, you know, cut down on corruption and narcotics and things like that. This is a mission that started in 2015. It has had very limited success. The Taliban has been gaining ground over the last year or so. There is a lot of debate and controversy over negotiating strategy for the Afghan government with the Taliban. And there is certainly a school of thought, even in the blob, that the United States should cut its investment in Afghanistan and help Ashraf Ghani cut a deal. So I don't think that it would be dismissed out of hand if the administration came up with a new approach. But I think mostly what we have here is a policy of benign neglect. And that's exactly why I think some of the NATO allies may start thinking about just backing slowly away.
And if they were to do that, would you mean practically speaking, it sounds like you can make the case that not much would change.
Well,
right. I mean, it puts a little bit more pressure on us, I guess, to bring force levels back to where they were absent.
Right. So would we make up the gap, or would we just reduce our presence as well? And it would be a kind of cut and run, but undeclared cut and run strategy.
All right. Let's move on. Let's cut and run from the news segment of the program.
That one was good.
That was good. Let's move on to object lessons. Ben, do you have an object?
So I do have an object.
Is it a Beyonce album?
It is not a Beyonce album. It's way nerdier than
Can
that.
Can you name a Beyonce song?
I cannot.
Can you name Beyonce's husband?
No.
Let's quiz Ben about
Beyonce. It's that singer, Jay-Z.
As he's known in the UK, Jay-Z.
It's that rapping artist.
A few weeks ago, I went out to Sausalito, California, to a meeting of a group that had been secret, but then the New York Times outed, which is called Patriots and Pragmatists, and which is a cross-ideological group of people concerned from an activist, intellectual, and other academic level about the future of democracy in the United States. And this group has been having these kind of retreat meetings for a while now. And those people who haven't read Yasha Monk's incredible article about it in Slate and the relationship that developed between him and David French, the National Review writer, as a result of these meetings, I strongly encourage it. But when I got to this meeting, the party favor for the meeting was a little button, a lapel button with the words Coalition of All Democratic Forces written on it, which is a reference to this hashtag that I had come up with before the Trump administration came in, right around the period of the election. I started tweeting about and writing on Lawfare about Coalition of All Democratic Forces, which I saw as a kind of cross-ideological, very much in the spirit of what became this Patriots and Pragmatists group. And so they had this these buttons printed up. And so my object lesson today is the Coalition of All Democratic Forces button, which I have.
You're going to have two lapel buttons.
Yeah, exactly, which I'm going to start wearing along with the Baby Cannon lapel pin.
You're going to have legit fruit salad.
I'm going to have like one on each side.
It's a good thing that a suit has two lapels.
It is. That's what they're for.
Very good. Very good. All right. My object is I speak on a lot of panels. I moderate a lot of panels.
You're good at it. You're a really good moderator.
I enjoy it.
Because you're good at the segues.
And I always say how glad I'm to be moderating your panel. And it's true. But I'm about to moderate a panel for which I have not ever been as excited to moderate a panel.
Oh, God.
Is Beyonce on it?
In my life. July 12th, which is a Thursday, there will be drinking involved from 6 to 8. New America is sponsoring a panel, Should We Communicate with Aliens? I will be joined.
I like the embedded assumptions throughout all of that.
Heat stroke so has good. Hit New America over there.
So good. I'm going to be joined by an honest-to-God astrophysicist and an honest-to-God astrobiologist.
What?
Let that sink in.
Okay. Dude.
Like Martian bacteria?
Are they going to record this panel?
They better.
And can we run it on the Lawfare podcast?
I mean, it was a condition of my joining. Okay, it wasn't really, but I will make it one.
Yeah, definitely have this, them send us the audio.
So I'm going to be with Lucianne Wolkowitz and Elisa Quintana asking this question, should we communicate with aliens? So the premise here being, you know, not just, you know, that we're past the whole question of disestrial terrestrial life exists, okay? I take it as a given. You know how I feel about this.
Jodie Foster told us it was there.
She totally told us it was there. We can totally build it.
They have
if we
seven
build
legs.
It, we can go.
Right.
That's how that works. That
and it's not can way. We talk to them, but it's
should we talk
it's
to them.
It's an ethical.
It's ethical. Well, it's actually, in fact, it is a security dilemma as well, because, I mean, this is a
but
question.
But not a rational security
No, no, it is. Let me tell you why. Because there's been the question raised of, like, here we are just floating around in our little secure system, of the part of the solar system. Like, if you alert intelligent life that has is just looking for planets to gobble up, that here we are. You know, what if they come and gobble us up? There's some people who would argue that we should just sit here quietly and don't draw attention to yourself.
But we already
sent
Voyager.
The galactic fleet is flying by.
We already sent them the Beatles was it the Rolling Stones?
I know. Well, but I don't think there was a Beatles song. Chuck Berry was the only rock and roll song on that album. Yeah, exactly. Only two copies in existence and we flung them into the stars. Oh, we're going to talk about that too. And you should come. So go to newamerica.org/events, I believe is where you're going to. Yeah, newamerica.org/.
I love this little obsession of yours.
It's going to be amazing, you guys. I cannot wait. 6 to 8 o'clock on Thursday, July 12th. Come. It's going from 6 to 8. It may go on till much later in the evening at a bar someplace.
Have fun, Shane.
I am going to have fun.
Follow your bliss, Shane.
Follow your bliss. Follow your bliss right to the end of this podcast. It was a blissful afternoon. Thank you all. Rational Security is brought to you by Lawfare. You can find our internet show page
on
on the Voyager probe.
No. You can find it on the Lawfare homepage at, I forget the URL, lawfare.com, lawfareblog.com/rationalsecurity.
Wow, an actual easy to find. It happened. It totally happened. We made contact. Wow, the eagle has landed.
Yes.
Dun-da-da-dun.
Dear God. I think we should just stop right here and start drinking.
Pigs are flying. Hell has frozen over.
You can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter at RATL Security. Whenever you download the podcast, please leave us a rating and review. It really helps us out. Our audio engineer this week was Matthew Kahn, who thinks we should not communicate with aliens, apparently. Takes my side on this. our producer was presented by Jen Patia Howell. Music this week. By Kim Jong-un and Beyonce and their new duo, Bay Twice.
What?
Excellent. Excellent.
Oh, my God.
He went there.
I'm going to pass out. Oh, but Sophia Yan will revive me with
Sophia
her
Yan,
tones.
Who's now also probably heard of Beyonce.
Probably heard of Beyonce. As
better
Kim
than Beyonce.
So is Kim
knows
Jong-un,
how to pronounce
just so we're clear. Kim Jong-un knows how to pronounce Beyonce. On behalf of my good friends Susan Hennessy, Tamara Kaufman-Wittes, and Ben Wittes, I'm Shane Harris. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks for listening.